Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the author of a new young adult thriller that's being compared to The Hunger Games. Matt Killeen is a former English sports journalist and advertising copywriter whose debut novel is the story of a Nazi Germany espionage ring and a real page-turner. Orphan Monster Spy revolves around a 15-year-old half-Jewish girl named Sarah, who happens to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Set in the opening days of World War II, Sarah has been homeschooled by her mother, an accomplished actress idled by the Nuremberg laws. As we meet them, they're attempting to flee Germany, but at a checkpoint, they're confronted, discovered, Sarah's mother is shot, and Sarah is on the run. But a mysterious man saves her, and she in turn saves him, a secret resistor of the Third Reich. And Sarah, with her Aryan features, is tasked to hide in plain sight at a Nazi-run boarding school in order to make connections with the daughter of an important Nazi physicist. It's a taut thriller for this debut novelist and a great summertime read for teenagers and as well as a few adults. Matt Killeen joins me as my guest today. Matt Killeen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Hello.
Your new book is a page-turning historical thriller set in the very opening days of World War II. What was the inspiration for Orphan Monster Spy?
Well, it was a combination of a few things. I mean, I grew up in the war-mad 1970s in the UK, where sort of from a child's point of view, everything was about the Second World War. All the comics, the books, the stories, the TV programs, the films that we wanted to see. And at the same time, my mother's best friend was German, so we spent sort of many happy summers with them. And they were warm and friendly and compassionate, wonderful hosts and rabidly pacifist. So, you know, I couldn't play play anything that involved violence of any kind or weapons without us sort of talking to her about where that might lead. And so there was a strange dichotomy there because, you know, it was very hard for a child to square the people that I had met with the people depicted in the stories. And as I got older and I discovered more about the Third Reich and the Holocaust, that dichotomy just grew ever more intense and it kind of laid down a lifetime's horrified fascination with the Second World War and the Third Reich and trying to figure out, like, how this could possibly happen. And I'd moved to South London, and I passed Stockwell Tube Station. There's a war memorial mural that has been painted there, and part of it was dedicated to Violet Szabo. Now, Violet Szabo was an SOE agent, and the SOE parachuted into occupied territory during the Second World War to organize resistance and cause trouble. And this was pretty much a suicide mission because the SOE weren't considered soldiers, they were spies, so they weren't considered prisoners of war. It meant that if they were captured, they could only look forward to sort of torture and death in a concentration camp. And I also looked at the dates of her death and I thought, gosh, she was very young when she died. And in my research, I discovered that she was just 21 when she volunteered. And that kind of blew my mind a little bit, because when I was 21, I was a mess, you know, and I wasn't much more mature at 21 than I had been at 17 or at 15. And it was at that moment that Sarah was kind of born in my head, pretty much fully formed, I think. And, you know, the story dictated some elements of her character. You know, she needed to be an outsider, so, you know, naturally sort of a German Jew fitted that perfectly.
This real-life character, Violet Szabo, I mean, she was perhaps one of the more successful SOE agents because from what I've read, a lot of these special operations executive people that went over into Europe were rounded up pretty quickly. She was one of the more successful, wasn't she?
Well, there were some issues with the French section. There was, I'm trying to remember the exact circumstances, but the Germans had cracked part of the code, and so they were able to intercept agents as they arrived and then kept asking for more agents, and we duly sent them. Violet Szabo she parachuted in twice. On the second occasion, she was intercepted almost by chance and captured after a standing fight. I don't know if Violet Szabo was necessarily the most successful. You know, there were SOE, female SOE agents that lived out the war, and some of them that had, you know, possibly more successful resistance careers. She just always spoke to me. I mean, I think the historian Lord Macaulay said in the 19th century that for history to be received by the reason, it has to be burnt into the imagination. And I think that it puts that piece of history into my head, kind of made it very real and resonant for me. You know, part of the reason that I've sort of written the book, and one of the reasons that it is in many ways like a thrilling spy romp, is that, you know, I want to make it as exciting and as resonant as possible.
Now, was this your first thriller that you've written?
I've been a professional writer for 13 years now, and I've spent the last 8 working for the Lego Company. So I've been writing comics and stories and activity pages. This is a very different feel. But this is, yes, I've did some prose and I've done some short stories, but this is the first full-length effort.
Well, it's an amazing debut, and of course it was the subject of a huge bidding war from publishers. And it's no surprise when you actually begin the book. I mean, it's breakneck from the very first moment. We meet Sarah Goldstein, who is the protagonist of the novel, and she and her mother are trying to make it out of the country. It's the days right before September 1939, just a couple of days before the war begins. They run a checkpoint, they're followed, and her mother is shot, and she's on the run. You know, normally that would end badly, but because Sarah is a resourceful young lady, a gymnast, and a very smart young lady, she manages to hide out, where she notices a man apparently looking with binoculars or looking around, and eventually they see each other. And this begins the story.
Yes. And he, of course, he's a British agent. And initially he is uncertain about her. He's been spotted. Ordinarily he would have just gone over and killed her. But he is intrigued. And then I think in his head it begins to crystallize. You see the story very much from Sarah's point of view. And I think very, very shortly after they meet, he is beginning to think that she might be the kind of person that he's looking for a very special mission.
That's right. An asset, as you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, at some point, very early in the novel, she has a chance to escape. He helps her. He gives her an identity. He gives her papers to get out of the country. And because of a circumstance where he is caught without his papers, she comes back for him. And then it's sealed. In the course of the novel, she basically decides to work for him as an asset. And this becomes the second part of it, the title Orphan Monster Spy. We know she's orphaned at the very beginning of the book. The second part is Monster. And this is another part where you did a lot of research on the political schools that the Nazis set up, probably even before the war, but certainly during the war. What was interesting to you about these schools that you decided to write about them?
Well, very early on in the story's genesis, I was thinking, well, you know, realistically, I kind of didn't want her to be a kind of Sten-gun-toting warrior, at least not this early in her career. So I was thinking of how, well, you know, where would a girl be most useful? And it all just began to crystallize in my head. I spent a lot of time reading, you know, boarding school stories when I was younger, and it kind of made sense. And I was thinking, oh, you know, I wonder, did the Nazis have schools where they trained up? It would make sense that they trained up some of the elite people for the SS. And I checked, and indeed the Napola schools existed, you know, with a reputation for brutality and you know, sort of very narrow political education.
Yeah, and you call them Napola. That was a term I was unfamiliar with. What does Napola stand for?
Goodness me, it's an extremely long German word, and I don't have it in front of me. You have caught me out. I think the translation is sort of national school.
But so the Napola schools were a real thing?
Yes, and I was actually surprised to learn that there were Napola schools for girls, because at least initially, the Third Reich considered women as, mothers and walking wombs, essentially. But I was surprised to learn that there were actually, I think, 3 Napola schools for girls. There's information on that is quite sketchy, but there is quite a lot of information on the BDM, the Girls Hitler Youth. And I think there's a tension in the way that this stuff is recorded. I think a lot of people who went to the Napola schools are very insecure about having gone through that experience, because, you know, I think that they thought and possibly did things that they would come to regret. And there are others who thought and did things then which actually they agreed with, and they've had to kind of deal with the fact that that's now considered unacceptable. It is interesting the way that as the generations who lived through the war and had direct experience of it are beginning to come to an age where they're beginning to pass away, people are making great efforts to record their oral histories. And people have been doing this for the Holocaust now for decades, whereas I think only now, in the last decade or so, people are beginning to record some of the Nazis' experience. And people are now of a sufficient age, they feel they can say what they actually think or what they actually felt at the time without fear of censure. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of interactions in the book are sort of paraphrases of events and incidents and phrases that I heard people use in these oral histories.
What were the things that really struck out about those oral histories? I would imagine they would have been really interesting, and I assume they're taken to sort of understand how a society goes so awry, horribly awry.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's one which I haven't used this particular memory yet, but I remember seeing an interview with somebody, and the woman was going, yes, it was terrible. Everybody was reporting on everybody else in, you know, in the town. And then they show her that she reported, they have a piece of paper which proves that she reported on a neighbor who was eventually carted away and died. And she had completely done an act of doublethink. She had forgotten that she did that, denied it, and then forgot that she was denying it. So when she was actually presented with the information, she could barely speak because she had rid herself of the memory of this terrible thing that she did. Mm. That was, in many ways, a typical thing to have happened in the Third Reich in Germany. But like, had been made very clear to those people that this was a terrible thing that they had done, and she had rid herself of this memory. And so she had this piece of paper in front of her, and it was like her signature. And she says, "Yes, that is my signature, but I can't tell you how that happened," when evidently she had done it. It's that kind of experience that that's an example of the kind of way in which you can tap into the emotional truth of the events and what people were going through at the time. And that's the kind of thing I use the oral histories for.
My guest today is writer Matt Killeen. His new book is titled Orphan Monster Spy. It's published by Viking, and a lot of people are comparing it to The Hunger Games. It's less overt action like The Hunger Games, but it is a great protagonist in Sarah Goldstein, or Ursula Haller, as she's called through a good part of the book. She is a 15-year-old Jewish girl who was on the run, who meets up with a British operative and goes undercover at a Nazi school to find out about a secret bomb being made. And we'll leave it at that. In crafting the character of Sarah Goldstein, you give us a real insight into what a fairly well-off Jewish family would have experienced through flashback during the 1930s. Sarah is apparently a very talented gymnast and had eyes for the Olympics, and yet she was unable to compete in gymnastics once the Nazis took power. Her mother was a talented actress, so you allude to productions of the Three Penny Opera, the music of Brecht, and in the course of the book. These were people who had successful careers who just, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, how could this get worse? How could this get worse? And yet every day it would get worse in the lead up to the 1930s.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it was kind of chosen to describe those things in flashback so that I can sort of pinpoint moments of the way in which their lives were kind of sliding away.
Tell me a little bit about crafting the character of Sarah Goldstein. You said the character came to you almost fully formed, but give us a sense of the work into understanding who this person would be who would willingly walk away from a chance at getting out of the Third Reich and coming back to work undercover to save a person that saved her in a way. But tell us a little bit about crafting this character.
She has a very fierce sense of right and wrong. I think because she has felt so wronged, and has, as a child, has had so little control over how her life has disintegrated. She has a very fierce sense of what is right and what is wrong. And I think that that happens a lot to a lot of young carers, people who have to look after older relatives. A lot of children who look after older relatives is the sort of fierce rage and a fierce sense of, well, sense of injustice about the world. And I think Sarah, the moment where she jumped, again, spoilers, I guess, but at the moment where she jumps off the ferry to go and save him, she spots in him, you know, it's a sort of a wave of empathy. She sees in him the person that she has been, and she wants to fix it. I think later in the book, with the mouse and the teacher, she is compelled to say something, to do something, because she knows what is happening is so wrong, that even if that feeling overwhelms her, and she kind of starts acting without thinking.
Yeah, that latter scene you're talking about is when she is in the Napola school, and she stands up for a bullied classmate and incurs the wrath of this fanatical teacher. And actually, it earns her some respect in the school and gets her towards her immediate objective without giving too much away. You mentioned, you know, you created her as a young carer. This is a child who's caregiving for a parent. And this is what's happened at we sort of learned through flashback as her mother was a talented actress and her life crumbles, her career crumbles because of the Nazis. Her life crumbles as well. And Sarah is increasingly a caregiver for her mother.
Yes. I had done some work for, my wife was actually on a board of a charity that deals with carers, not young carers specifically, but, you know, I think in most of the Western world, we have an aging population, and so we have more and more people are having to provide care for relatives in a way that just can end their connection with normal society. And it's something that most civilized nations need to take care of pretty soon. And I learned a lot about young carers as well, is that, you know, there are children as young as 12 in the UK and in the US that are having to care for parents and relatives. And, you know, those people are more likely to be bullied. They are more likely to suffer from mental health problems. And I feel very strongly about that I think society is letting these families down quite profoundly. So that idea of her as a young carer kind of was sort of there from the beginning, kind of arrived again in her fully formed state.
Hmm. Now, without giving too much away, there is another real character that appears in the book. We mainly learn about her through other people telling us about her. But it was a real scientist named Lisa Meitner. Put this in here. Why was this an important character for you?
I think in many ways she sort of symbolized the ongoing, you know, issues with patriarchal society and the levels of white male straight privilege in the world. That she was a phenomenal scientist. You know, she had, as I've written in the end of the book, I mean, you know, this was somebody, she wasn't just a great scientist in that she was methodical and intelligent and she had vision, you know, that she and her nephew basically went for a walk and figured out how, you know, one of the fundamental parts of physics and chemistry worked, like just by talking it through, you know, from data that had bemused the greatest minds of her generation. And she was, although she was Christian, she was of Jewish descent, and so when Austria was annexed by Nazi Germany, she was sort of driven out of her job, and she fled first to the Netherlands and then to Sweden. And it was there that she had still been receiving the information from her colleagues and friends in Berlin, and she figured out what this data meant, that she basically established the idea of nuclear fission. And she, as a woman and as a Jew, she had been sort of overlooked, you know, even in Swedish academic society. When she did have an opportunity to joined the Manhattan Project, but she was a pacifist and was dead set against the idea of a nuclear bomb. So she didn't join them. And then after the war, she was the sort of German, the cream of German nuclear science, were put under house arrest in some comfort. And they, between them, thrashed out how they were going to talk to the world in future. And that they were going to say, you know, well, we didn't make the bomb. You know, we were never going to make the bomb, but we are responsible for this sort of breakthrough. You know, it was German science that did this. And in doing so, they sort of pushed Lisa Meitner's name completely out, because to admit that she had been an important part in the process and that they had allowed her to be pushed out of the country was too embarrassing for them. So they wrote her out of history, essentially. And her colleague got the Nobel Prize for physics for the discovery, and Lisa Meitner was never named, because they said, oh, she wasn't involved and she left anyway, forgetting that she'd been driven out of the country. And then she was also overlooked for the chemistry Nobel Prize for reasons that are almost inexplicable, but, I mean, an act of phenomenal sexism. And so as somebody who had been discriminated against because she was Jewish, because she was a woman, because she was a refugee, she's a symbol of how those things still exist today. And so I wanted to immortalize her in some small way and draw attention to it.
Well, this book is a page-turner from beginning to end. The name of it is Orphan Monster Spy, a story of Sarah Goldstein as she moves through a Nazi school, passing as an Aryan. She has blonde hair, blue eyes, but doing undercover work with a British operative. And it's a fascinating, wonderful read, Orphan Monster Spy. But I should mention, this is not your only book that's out this spring. You have another collection of essays, which sort of mention a few of the people we've talked about during this interview. It's titled The Women Who Made Me a Feminist. And it includes profiles of Violet Szabo and many others. What was this book? Where did this book come from?
Almost happened by accident. I mean, I think it has been impossible to do any publicity or promotion for this book and not talk about my feminism and how important I think it is for society. And I wrote, I think it was the Violet Szabo profile. And then somebody said, for somebody's web blog, and then somebody else said, oh, could you write one of those for me? And then they said, I'll tell you what, could you write one for every stop on your blog tour? And I said, okay. And then I looked, and there were 17 stops on the blog tour. And this is why the sequel's going to be late. and sort of by the time I had written them all, they kind of, my publisher said, we have to do something with these. People need to see them. So now you can get it's a free Kindle book. And they are people, you know, some fictional, some real, and they are not necessarily all sort of feminist icons. You know, most fictional women have elements of being problematic. But they were all people who had an influence on me. You know, why representation is so important is, you know, when I was 5, I saw Princess Leia, or General Organa, depending on how you want to say it. And, you know, that became a template of what I saw women could be. You know, in charge, intelligent, resourceful, brave, and incredibly resilient. You know, I mean, if you look at the circumstances in the original Star Wars, you know, she has her planet blown up, loses her entire family and millions of her friends, and then she's tortured. She doesn't give up any information, and then a stormtrooper walks into her cell, probably to take her to her execution, and she makes fun of him. And that's, you know, that's some woman, that's some human being. And this is why representation is important, is that people need to see the kind of people that can be out there, you know?
And your protagonist, Sarah, although she has her own demons that you write about in the book, she is a tough young lady.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I've always felt that it is more important that main protagonists who are women are sort of multifaceted and kind of well-written and deep than they are necessarily strong and likable. And I think it's important for female characters to not necessarily be considered strong because they are exhibiting traditional male roles. I mean, I think if you look at somebody like, you mentioned The Hunger Games, I'm a big fan of The Hunger Games, that Katniss Everdeen's defining core value is her compassion and her nurturing. And the whole book takes place, the whole trilogy and the revolution and everything that happens as a result takes place because she is compassionate and nurturing. You know, she sacrifices her life for her sister. There would have been no idea in her head that she could have then won the Hunger Games and survived, because nobody from District 12 survived. You know, there was one in the last, you know, 74 years, and that was long before she was born. And I hope that Sarah is, I hope that she's well-written, but, you know, I do think she's multifaceted. I don't think she's always likable, which I think is also good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm often asked, who would you like to take to dinner from your book? And I'm going, I don't know if I'd want to sit around the table with any of them. I mean, goodness me. I think most interesting characters are slightly traumatized.
So. Right. I mean, you know, you've spent so much time putting it together, what you hope is going to be a well-received novel. Have you been gratified or surprised otherwise by the reception of the book?
I mean, incredibly gratified. I've been very, very pleased with how it's been accepted.
Well, it certainly reads as if we're going to see it on the screen at some point. Has it been optioned for a film yet?
There is. I don't know how much I can talk about. There is a production company that is putting together, I believe they call it a package now. And then I think they have 3 months to decide if they're going to go ahead with that. So I would say it's possible. They have a very good reputation for producing, for getting stuff produced. So,
all right.
Fingers crossed.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Orphan, Monster, Spy. It's published by Viking. Matt Killeen, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Debut novelist Matt Killeen speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new novel is titled Orphan, Monster, Spy. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Scott Gregory inviting you to join us every Saturday night from 9 to midnight here on Public Radio 89.5 for all this jazz, modern jazz, both recent and classic across a range of styles. And every week in the third hour of our show from 11 to 12, we offer a theme. Again, all this jazz, Saturday nights at 9. Hope you can join us.